The following previews are of graphic audio productions rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
You are Amanda Carter.
You are Anver Bajraktari. Do you have the items we discussed?
Come inside.
What's a Greek coin doing here? I thought these artifacts were Nepali. What the hell do you think you're doing?
There has been a change of plan.
I am Sergeant Panteras Katramados, and you are under arrest for trafficking in illicit antiquities.
Don't take me in yet. I was hired by the Japan Buddhist Federation to figure out why Greek coins are turning up in plunder from a Buddhist shrine in Nepal.
I accept your story. For now, but I shall keep an eye on you, Anya Creed.
It is said that shortly after Gotama's death, one of his disciples decided to exalt the Enlightened One in the heights of the world. The shrine could only be found by a quest. This is your path, Anya Creed. It is the road you must follow to find that which you seek.
We bring you news from our places, comrade. First, a meddling American woman named Anya Creed caused us to lose our last shipment to the Greek police. The good news is that the witch has come to Nepal.
How is it good news that this meddlesome Western woman has come here?
Because she's on the trail of the greatest treasure trove in the Himalayas. All we have to do is follow her, and she'll lead us to unimaginable wealth.
Press up. How much further?
Not far. Another hour or two.
That may be too long. They're getting close.
Storm clouds ahead. We shall be in it soon.
We have to keep moving!
There it is.
They've pulled back. We should check out the cave.
Oh my God.
I cannot let you tell the world of this. I'll die first.
You're right about one thing. You will die.
You have given me a very great deal of trouble, Miss Creed. I am about to shoot you in the belly.
Rogue Angel 19, Seeker's Curse, in graphic audio.
Do you know your name?
Gailara Vada.
And do you know where you are?
You're the mercenaries.
Yes.
When can I get back to my ship?
After the Major talks to you, probably.
Captain Vada, we have a problem. We need a place to stash some neutral civilians. Your ship is more than adequate for that task.
Have you ever been in charge of a refugee situation?
No? You have suggestions?
The captains of the other civ ships are gonna think they should be running this. You have to convince them otherwise.
We want to talk to you.
This is ridiculous!
Unbelievable!
You get us killed!
Come on!
You're exceeding your authority!
This is a cargo hold!
Enough! I'm lucky to be alive, and so are you. Don't push your luck!
You know, from inside those cargo holds, they don't have far to go to access the linkages with hardware.
If they wanted to mess us up, they could.
I was afraid of that.
Drive just came on, Captain. Full boost. I can't get it off.
And I can't get anywhere with the nav board.
It's time to let more experienced officers take over.
Don't do it, Kai!
Gary?
Don't let him get the ship!
Let him go.
Hand us your captain's wallet. Then we'll see.
Vata's War. Book 1. Trading in Danger. Part 2. In graphic audio.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's The Last Gunfighter. Narrated by Ken Jackson. With performances by James Konacek, Thomas Penny, Johann Detweiler, Eric Messner, Andy Clements, James Lewis, Tom Simpson, Dylan Lynch, Mort Shelby, Richard Rowan, Terrence Aselford, Joe Brack, Bryn Casey, Stephen Carpenter, Tim Carlin, Casey Platt, Colleen Delaney, and Nanette Savard. The Last Gunfighter, number 17, Ambush Valley.
Peace and quiet. Nothing like it.
Frank Morgan crouched low in Leo Benjamin's general store as a bullet chewed splinters from the door jamb next to his head.
Marshal, what is it?
The Emporium's customers, several men and women, all crouched in the aisles and looked around wildly, not quite sure what to do. All hell was breaking loose in the main street of Buckskin, Nevada, the silver mining town where Frank Morgan had been the marshal for about 6 months.
Not sure just yet, Leo. Looks like a robbery. Everyone, just keep your heads down. You'll be all right.
Peace had reigned in Buckskin ever since the labor unrest that had shut down the mines for a while and the raid by a gang of notorious outlaws. That sure wasn't the case today. Frank had been ambling along the boardwalk in front of the store when several men came boiling out of the office of the Lucky Lizard Mining Company down the street. They had bandanas pulled up over their faces to serve as crude masks. That by itself would have been enough to alert Frank to the fact that something was wrong. But then the varmints had started shooting, too. Frank had dived into Leo's store to avoid the hail of lead. Frank knew that the merchant kept a loaded Winchester under the counter.
Leo, toss me your rifle. Everybody stay down!
Leo reached under the counter, brought out the Winchester, and pitched it with both hands toward Frank. The marshal grabbed it and wheeled back to the doorway. Frank went through the door in a low dive that landed him prone on the boardwalk. Frank worked the rifle's loading lever as he brought the weapon to his shoulder. He drew a bead on one of the riders charging down the street. The .44-40 slug punched into the outlaw's chest and swept him backward out of the saddle. One of his feet caught in the stirrup, though, so he was dragged along the street by the still galloping horse. Frank had worked the Winchester's lever again and shifted his aim. He fired a second shot. This time, the bullet struck one of the bandits in the right shoulder and twisted him halfway around in the saddle, but he managed to stay on his horse. There were four outlaws in all, Frank saw now. The other two had taken notice of him and directed their fire where he lay on the boardwalk. He rolled swiftly to his right as bullets smacked into the planks where he had been a heartbeat earlier. Pushing off with his feet, Frank lunged off the boardwalk and landed behind one of the water troughs that were spaced at intervals along the street. Frank began firing as fast as he could work the rifle's lever, coming up on his knees as he did so. The bandits had their backs to Frank now, but that didn't particularly bother him. They had started the ball, and the way they were still slinging lead around, they were a danger to the town. His town. Anybody who threatened the people of Buckskin would damn well get what was coming to them, at least as long as Frank Morgan was the marshal. The deadly volley from Frank's Winchester tore through the fleeing outlaws. They plunged from their saddles and thudded to the dirt of the street. The man Frank had wounded in the shoulder was in the lead. He made it all the way to the edge of town before loss of blood made him pass out. He toppled off his horse, too. All four of the hombres were down now. Frank ran to each of the men in turn, keeping the Winchester ready to fire again if he needed to. There was no need. Three of the men were dead, and the fourth, the one with the bullet-shattered shoulder, was out cold.
Frank! You all right?
Frank's deputy, the lean, buckskin-clad former prospector called Catamount Jack, came running along the street with his big old cap and ball pistol clutched in a gnarled hand.
I'm fine. Keep an eye on this one. The others are done for, but he's still alive.
Does somebody need to fetch Doc Garland? Or do we just let the son of a bitch bleed to death and save the trouble of a hanging?
We're not letting anybody bleed to death.
A crowd was starting to gather now that the shooting was over.
Eddie, run get Dr. Garland to tend to that fella. Dave, might as well let Claude Langley know his services will be needed for the other three.
Never seen an undertaker yet who didn't come a-running anytime there was a shooting.
You stay here, Jack. I'm gonna head down to the Lucky Lizard office. These guys were up to something. I want to find out what.
You think Tip or Diana were in there?
Don't know, but I need to find out.
Thomas Tip Woodford, the owner of the mine and the mayor of Buckskin, might have been in the office when the outlaws came storming in. Diana Woodford, Tip's beautiful blonde daughter, might also have been there. Diana had taken a romantic interest in Frank when he first came to the settlement, despite the fact that he considered her to be about 20 years too young for him. He had been successful in deflecting her attention to Garrett Claiborne, the mining engineer who worked as the superintendent of the Crown Royal Mine, but Frank still considered Diana a good friend and was concerned about her and her father as he hurried toward the office. Tip emerged from the building before Frank got there. The beefy, florid-faced former prospector who had hit it rich with the Lucky Lizard had a hand pressed to his head. Blood seeped between his fingers. He was a little unsteady, and Diana was right beside him with an arm around him, helping to support him. Frank felt a surge of relief when he saw that Diana seemed to be unharmed.
What happened, Tip?
Did you get him? Did you get the thieving bastards, Frank?
I got him. Are you shot?
Nah. One of them walloped me with his gun when I didn't move fast enough to suit him.
I thought they were gonna kill him. Are they all dead, Marshal?
She sounded like she hoped they were. Diana had a bit of a bloodthirsty streak in her that came out every so often.
Three are. The other ones hit bad. Let me have a look at your head, Tip.
Woodford moved his bloody hand away from his head. Frank saw the gash that had been opened up in Tip's graying, rust-colored hair. The injury was messy, but not too serious. Head wounds always bled a lot.
We better go find Dr. Garland. You're liable to need a few stitches.
I'm all right.
No, you're not. Come on, Pa.
Are you able to walk?
Yes, I ain't dead.
What do those polecats want?
Payroll for the Lucky Lizard came in on this morning's stage. They knew about it somehow, figured to grab it before I could take it out to the mine and pay off the boys.
Did they get it?
Yeah. Didn't have no choice but to hand it over. It might have hurt Diana if I hadn't.
I told you, Pa, I wasn't scared.
Well, I was scared enough for both of us, I reckon.
Frank doubted that. Tip Woodford was a salty old-timer. If Diana hadn't been there when the outlaws burst in, likely he would have told them to go to hell. But no amount of money was worth his daughter's safety to Tip. Frank understood that feeling. He had a son of his own, although he didn't see Conrad very often. And in his heart of hearts, he was convinced that he had a daughter, too. Although Mercy Moncure, his first love back in Weatherford, Texas, had never confirmed, or denied for that matter, that her daughter, Victoria, was his. As they walked along the street, Frank's eyes found the horses that the outlaws had been riding. All four animals had come to a stop at the edge of town and were milling around there now, unsure of what they were supposed to do.
Well, looks like you'll be okay with your payroll, Tip.
Are those the polecat's horses?
Yeah, looks like they got tired of running and just stopped here.
And that canvas bag on the saddle is the payroll, Pa.
Yep, that's it, all right.
That's good, Tip.
Frank, I just don't know how those guys knew the payroll would be here.
Well, somebody at the bank in Virginia City could have told the outlaws that the money was arriving in Buckskin this morning. Or someone connected with the stage line could be guilty of that.
There had to be someone else involved somewhere.
Well, we'll get to the bottom of that later. Right now, let's just get you the necessary medical attention.
As Frank, Tip, and Diana came up, Dr. William Garland straightened from where he had been kneeling beside the wounded outlaw. Garland was a young, slightly built man with brown hair who usually had an intense expression on his slender face. Today was no different.
What happened to you, Mayor?
One of those varmints pistol whipped me.
Let me take a look.
How bad is it, Doc?
I need to stitch it up, but you should be fine. You probably have a slight concussion, too, so you have to take it easy for a few days. Miss Woodford, why don't you help your father over to my office? I'll be there in a few minutes.
All right, Doctor.
I can't take it easy. I got a mind to run.
I'm perfectly capable of taking care of things for a few days. In fact, if I had been in charge of things, I would have had an armed guard waiting when that payroll was delivered, and it would have been guarded until all the men had received their wages.
I guess you're right, honey.
Tip grumbled, but Frank hoped he would pay attention to what Diana was saying. Frank had been planning to suggest the same thing himself.
What about this guy, Doc?
I think he'll live, but he'll never have full use of his right arm again.
Since that looks to be his gun arm, I reckon that's probably a good thing.
I'll get some men to carry him down to my office. Can't do anything with him here in the street.
All right, Doc. And thanks. Take good care of the mayor.
Of course.
Jack, you stay here and make sure everything gets cleaned up. I'm gonna take the payroll over to the office and put it in the safe. Then I'll take these Owl Hoots horses over to Amos at the livery. I want to go through their stuff and see what I can find out about them.
I doubt you'll find out much, Frank. These kind don't generally keep a hold of things from their past.
You're probably right, but it won't hurt to take a look.
I'll be right with you, Marshal. Just need to finish making some notes here.
Being called Marshal still confused Frank a bit. Morgan's career as a law enforcement officer had been pretty spotty. He had pinned on a badge a time or two before coming to Buckskin, and on several occasions he had pitched in to help a friend of his, Texas Ranger Tyler Beaumont. But that had been on an unofficial basis. A personal quest for vengeance had brought Frank to Buckskin. He'd found that he liked the settlement and the people who lived here, and when Tip Woodford and some of the other leading citizens had asked him to stay and take on the job of Marshal, Frank had surprised himself by accepting. Now here he was, a few hours after the shootout with the men who had stolen the Lucky Lizard payroll, waiting to talk to Doc Garland and investigating a crime. Once there had been quite a few men like Frank Morgan in the West. Wild Bill Hickok, Ben Thompson, Matt Bodine, John Wesley Hardin, Falcon McAllister, and the man who some said was the fastest there ever was or ever would be, Smoke Jensen. Call them shootists, pistoliers, gunfighters. No matter the name by which they were known, they were a dying breed now in the waning days of the 19th century. Frank Morgan sometimes felt that he was indeed the last of them. But then somebody else would come along, determined to kill him and make a name for himself as a gunfighter. A part of Frank believed that for him it would never end until he was dead. No matter where he rode or how much he sought peace, he could almost believe he had found it here in Buckskin. But then some ruckus like the one today would break out, and the killing would start again.
There now. How can I help you, Marshal?
How's that outlaw doing?
He's awake now. I was just about to send for you, Marshal. Figured you'd want to question him.
Yeah, there are a few things I'd like to know.
Right this way, then.
Frank followed Garland to a small room where the wounded bandit was half propped up on a narrow table. The man's right arm was in a sling, and heavy bandages were wrapped around his shoulder. His beard-stubbled face was pale and drawn. His left wrist was tied securely to the bedpost with a short length of rope.
Your deputy tied him up like that.
Yeah, I told him to stop by and do that while this fellow was still unconscious. I didn't want him taken off for the tall and uncut once he came to.
I'm not sure a restraint is necessary. He's really too weak from loss of blood to go anywhere or cause any trouble.
Better not to take a chance. A fella can usually find a little extra strength if it means avoiding a hang rope.
A hang rope? I ain't done nothing to deserve hanging. I ain't never killed nobody in my life.
Yeah, well, that's no fault of your own. The way you're throwing lead around in the street this morning with those other three.
What happened to them? Nobody'll tell me anything, damn it!
That was another order Frank had given. This man was to be kept in the dark about what had happened to his companions.
They're probably way up in the High Lonesome by now, along with that payroll money.
They got away? With the money?
That's right. They couldn't abandon you quick enough, hombre.
Those...
You didn't expect them to stay behind and get caught just because you got shot, did you? They had the money. That is all they cared about.
Oh, dirty sons. We said we'd stick together. Damn their hides.
Tell me who they were.
As expected, Frank hadn't found anything in the saddlebags that had belonged to the dead men to tell him their identities.
Maybe that helped me track them down.
I don't know.
I imagine they'll be living high and wide and handsome in San Francisco within a week or two. As much loot as they carried off.
All right! They're Johnny Blanco, Matt Higgins, and Ed Renko. Those are the names I know them by anyway.
What about you?
I'm Cullen Bradley.
Where are you from, Bradley?
Poplar Bluff, Missouri. That's where I grew up anyway. I've been on the drift for the past few years. That's where I met Johnny and Matt and Ed. On the trails with the Night Owls Hoot, if you know what I mean.
I know, boy. I've ridden a few of those trails myself.
You ain't really gonna hang me, are you, Marshal?
Give me one good reason why I shouldn't.
Wouldn't be right. Like I told you, I've never killed nobody. I stole before in my life, sure, but I draw the line at killing. You might not have noticed, but every shot I fired this morning went high on purpose.
I saw you shooting, son. You weren't aiming deliberately high. If you're right about never killing anybody, it is because you're a poor shot.
But in the absence of proof, Frank didn't intend to try to send the outlaw to the gallows. Bradley didn't have to know that just yet, though.
No! I'm telling the truth!
I don't think a judge and jury will believe that, Bradley. And even if they do, I'm not sure they'll care. The mayor was pistol-whipped.
Yeah, I didn't do that neither! That was Johnny Blanco done it! I never hurt nobody!
Folks might be more inclined to believe you if you're willing to help us out, am I?
What do you want me to do? I'll do anything!
Tell me how the four of you knew the payroll money was going to be in the Lucky Lizard office this morning.
It was a fella who works at the bank in Virginia City who told us. He used to ride with Johnny before he went straight. His name's Russell.
That his first name or last name?
Hell if I know. I never heard Johnny call him anything except Russell.
All right. I'll send word to the authorities in Virginia City and let them figure it out. I reckon they could find this fella Russell and see that he gets what's coming to him for helping you.
What about me? Are you still gonna hang me?
He'll stand trial for robbery, assault, and attempted murder. What the court does with you isn't up to me.
You're not gonna just string me up?
You're lucky Tip Woodford wasn't hurt any worse than he was. And that his daughter wasn't hurt at all. If they had been, well, I wouldn't have wanted to be you, Bradley.
He needs some rest, Marshal. Let's talk in the office.
Take care of him, Doc. I'll deputize a couple of men to stand guard over him until he can be moved to the jail. How long you reckon that'll be?
Give me a day or two, Marshal, just to make sure he's out of the woods. Then you can take him over and put him behind bars where he deserves to be.
That'll be just fine.
Will he be sentenced to hang?
Well, not likely. He'll be sent to prison, though, that's for sure.
It's been peaceful here for a while. I hope today's events don't signal a return to the sort of violence that used to plague this town.
You and me both, Doc. You and me both.
But unknown to Frank Morgan, events were taking place far to the south that would have an effect on his desire for peace and quiet. The seeds of brutal violence and deadly peril were already being sown. Despite the heat, the eight men who rode into Tucson wore long dusters over their range clothes. Their hats were pulled down low to shield their faces from the sun and to make it harder for anyone to get a good look at their features. They reined to a halt in front of the First Territorial Bank, which was a large red brick building, and as they dismounted, the long coats swung back a little to reveal guns in low-slung holsters. If anyone had been paying any attention, these eight strangers surely would have aroused some suspicion. But it was the middle of the afternoon, and mighty hot, as it always was in Tucson, and the few folks who were out and about instead of snoozing in the shade somewhere just wanted to finish whatever errands had brought them out and get back to somewhere cooler. So nobody on the street had really noticed the eight strangers. But Randall Berry did as they strode into the bank.
Oh no.
He saw the dusters, the tugged down hats, the way the men pulled bandanas up over the lower half of their faces as they entered the building, so that only their eyes were visible. Randall Berry was a teller in the First Territorial Bank, and as he saw the men, he knew that what was coming was bad. He had every intention of screaming out a warning, but he never got the chance. The man who was in the forefront of the sinister group swept his hand under his duster, came up with a gun, and fired. The bullet struck Randall Berry just above the right eye, and the impact flung Berry backward in his teller's cage. He flew off the stool where he had been sitting and crashed to the floor on his back. The gunshot and Randall Berry's death got not only the attention of everybody else in the bank, but their terrified silence too. And that was just the way Cicero McCoy wanted it.
Nobody move! This is a holdup!
He had learned over the course of a career in lawlessness that had lasted for several years that sudden, unexpected death made people freeze at first so that instinct didn't make them try to fight back. Then fear that they would be the next victim prompted them to cooperate.
That shot's gonna bring the law, boss.
It usually does. Just work fast and we'll be gone before the law knows we were here.
Sure thing, boss.
Half a dozen people were in the bank, not counting the dead teller. Three customers, two more tellers, and the bank manager. They all stared at the outlaws in shock and horror. The dust-clad robbers spread out through the big room. One man covered the manager, while another leveled his gun at the pair of terrified tellers. A third man herded the customers together and warned them not to try anything or they would die. That left four men with canvas sacks to clean out the tellers' cages and the vault, which the manager was forced to open at gunpoint.
Work faster, boys. We've only got a couple minutes before we can expect company.
With the metronomic certainty of a clock, the seconds ticked away inside McCoy's head. He knew that if they were in and out of the bank in no more than 2 minutes, they stood a good chance of getting away clean. Unfortunately for McCoy and his gang, today the sheriff happened to be only a few doors away, rather than in his office at the other end of town. He stood talking to a shop owner when he heard the shot.
That was a gunshot.
At the sound of the shot, the law officer jerked his revolver from its holster.
It came from the bank. Everyone get inside and stay down. What the hell's going on here? A bank robbery? God, this is Tucson, not Tombstone.
But they were still in the West, and train robberies and bank holdups still took place. Here and there, stagecoach lines still operated, and the stages got held up too. So the sheriff figured outlaws had hit the bank, and as he stood outside the big brick building, he saw that he was right. Men wearing dusters, pulled down hats and bandana masks, ran out of the bank and headed for horses tied at the hitch rack in front of the building.
Hold her right there, you bastards!
The sheriff felt the jolt as a bullet burned along his left forearm. The sheriff triggered two shots and threw himself off the boardwalk, landing behind a water trough. He didn't have any idea if his bullets had hit any of the bandits, and at the moment he didn't care. He made himself as small a target as he could as he huddled behind the trough.
Let's go!
Ride hard, boys! Ride hard!
McCoy jerked on the reins and wheeled his horse around. The plan was for them to head southwest out of Tucson. There wasn't much but rugged country in that direction between the settlement and the border. Mountains of desert, ravines, and towering spires of rock. Ugly country where a man on the run could disappear. That was exactly what Cicero McCoy intended to do. Shots began to blast here and there as townies tried to stop them. When a man ran out in front of them brandishing a shotgun, McCoy shot him down without hesitation. Killing didn't bother McCoy, had never fazed him. People usually got what they deserved in life, he figured, and if they got in his way, that was their own lookout and not his problem. The robbers had left behind two dead men inside the bank. The manager had gotten brave at the last minute and made a grab for a gun in his desk. A couple of McCoy's men had filled him with lead. In all, three people had died in Tucson as a result of the robbery. There wasn't a whole lot Conrad Browning liked about the West. It was still rough and uncivilized, and he much preferred Boston. But he had to admit that some things out here weren't too bad, like the idea of a siesta. Stretching out for a while in the midst of the day, on a comfortable bed inside a hotel room with thick adobe walls to keep most of the heat out, that wasn't bad at all. Especially when you had your beautiful naked wife right beside you. Rebel was lying on her stomach, dozing. Conrad propped himself on an elbow and ran his fingertips along her spine, following it down to the curve of her hips.
Hey, you awake?
His touch made her stir. She turned her face toward him and smiled, although her eyes remained closed.
So soon, Conrad?
They had been married for only a few months, so the wanting for each other was still strong in both of them. Conrad moved closer to her, took her in his arms. She turned and found his mouth with hers. Their kisses were eager.
Was that a gunshot?
Oh, don't worry about it, Conrad. Probably just some cowboy letting off steam in one of the saloons down the street.
Rebel was a Westerner, so she knew about such things. Conrad had met her a year and a half earlier over in New Mexico territory when trouble cropped up on a railroad spur line one of his companies was building. Conrad's father, Frank Morgan, had been mixed up in that affair too. But everything had been straightened out in the end, and Conrad had found himself falling in love with the wild and beautiful Rebel Callahan. They had been married a year later in Boston. Conrad felt an occasional twinge of guilt that they hadn't invited Frank to the wedding. If not for him, the two of them might not have ever gotten together. But Conrad had spent a lot of years hating Frank Morgan, and it took time to get over something like that. They saw each other from time to time and got along all right now, but they would never be close, and Conrad was all right with that.
Hey, do you mind? You woke me up. Now get back down to business, husband.
Why, of course, wife.
What the hell is going on out there?
Sounds like a war has broken out.
Oh, and our side's losing.
Conrad went to the window and thrust the curtain back. He saw several riders in long coats galloping out of town, shooting as they fled.
It looks like some desperados making a getaway.
And he realized a second later that the First Territorial Bank, which was owned by the Browning Banking Trust and was the reason he and Rebel had stopped in Tucson, was just down the street.
Oh, my God. I wonder if they robbed the bank.
You're going down there?
I have to find out what happened. If the bank was robbed, some of the employees might have been hurt.
There was a time when Conrad wouldn't have cared so much about the lives of the people who worked for him. They did their jobs, they were paid their wages, and that was the end of it as far as he was concerned. He supposed that being around Frank had caused some of his father's attitudes to rub off on him, at least a little.
Oh, let me go with you.
No. I want you to stay here where it's safe. They might come back.
Not if they already robbed the bank, they won't. They'll want to put as much distance as they can between them and Tucson.
Please stay here, Rebel. I'll be back in a few minutes.
Conrad Browning was running hard toward the bank. He spotted a man with a sheriff's badge pinned to his vest climbing to his feet next to a water trough. Obviously, the lawmen had taken cover there when the shooting started.
Sheriff, what happened? I'm told the bank was robbed.
Who the hell are you?
Conrad Browning. I own the bank.
The sheriff looked surprised. Conrad knew he didn't fit the popular image of a banker. He was too young, for one thing, and with his fair hair and slender build, he wasn't physically imposing by any means. But that didn't stop him from owning not only banks, but also mines, railroads, factories, and dozens of other business enterprises scattered from one end of the country to the other.
Yeah, I saw some fellas who looked like bandits come running out of the bank. I traded a few shots with them, but there were too many of them for me to slow them down.
So you took shelter instead?
It wouldn't have helped anything to get myself shot full of holes, Mr. Browning. Somebody's got to put together a posse and go after those sons of bitches. First, I gotta find out just what happened.
The lawman strode toward the bank, his gun still gripped tightly in his hand. Conrad fell in step beside him.
I was watching from the hotel as the robbers shot a man who was in their way.
Yeah, I saw that too.
Oh my God, thank God you're here, Sheriff! Oh, those men! They shot Mr. Wick! Oh God, I think he's dead! And poor Randall Berry, too!
Take it easy now. You need to tell me everything so we can get after these men.
Okay. Oh, God. There were 8 of them. As soon as they walked through the door, they shot Randall dead.
Oh, God. Take it easy, son. You have to tell me all of it.
I'm sorry. Oh, God, they cleaned out the teller's cages and the vault. Then they shot Mr. Wick as they were leaving. I'm sorry, Mr. Browning, they got everything.
You don't worry about that. There was nothing you could do about it.
Browning, if they got everything, how much are we talking about?
A little over $80,000, Sheriff.
Conrad watched as a woman he assumed to be the bank manager's wife ran into the bank and was confronted with what the robbers had taken from her. His mind flashed back to his own mother's death. Vivian Browning had been the finest woman who ever lived, at least as far as Conrad was concerned, and she had lost her life because of a gang of vicious outlaws. Vivian Browning's death had been avenged. Frank Morgan had seen to that, although it had taken several years to track down all the men responsible. When the last one of them was dead, Frank had written a letter to Conrad telling him about it, although Frank hadn't gone into any great detail. That was all right with Conrad. It was enough for him to know that the score had been settled. He asked himself, who would settle this score? Who would see to it that the men responsible for the deaths of these good people paid the price for their evil?
Shouldn't you get started organizing a posse, Sheriff?
Yeah. I'll spread the word that I'm looking for volunteers.
You'll get more volunteers if you tell them about the reward.
What reward?
The one that I'm posting for the return of the town's money and the apprehension of the men responsible for this atrocity. $10,000. Dead or alive.
When the shooting started, Abner Hoyt was in bed with a woman, too. Unlike Conrad Browning, the woman wasn't Hoyt's wife. She was a whore named Delia he had brought upstairs to her room in the Ace's Full Saloon. He was finished with her, so when he heard the shots, he decided he might as well go see what was going on. Might be something interesting. He sure as hell wasn't interested in Delia, now that he had done what he wanted with her.
Sounds like some new cowboys in town having fun. Well, you got some time left, mister. Anything else you want to do?
Nope. We're done here.
Delia pouted like she was disappointed. There was a slim chance that the expression was at least somewhat genuine. Abner Hoyt was a big, muscular man, and while his face was a little too rugged to be called handsome, it did possess a certain strength that most women found attractive. His thick, sandy hair was long, hanging down almost to his shoulders, and his mustache drooped down on both sides of his wide mouth. He slid his long legs into denim trousers and pulled a buckskin shirt over his head. His feet went into high-topped black boots, and he settled a battered cavalry hat on his head. He'd been out of the army for a long time, but he still had the hat. A gun belt with a holstered Colt on the right side and a sheathed Bowie knife on the left completed his outfit. He'd already put a coin on the scarred dresser before he'd ever climbed into the bed with Delia, so his business with her was done. He gave her a curt nod and left the room. Downstairs, the saloon's few midday customers and the bartender, Pudge Carlton, were gathered at the front windows and the bat-winged entrance, craning their necks to try to get a glimpse of what was going on outside.
What's going on, Pudge?
Well, looks like somebody robbed the bank. Shut it up pretty good from what I can tell.
No kidding.
I should have known, Hoyt. A bank robbery may be a tragedy to some, but to you, it's a business opportunity.
Fellas got to make a living, Pudge.
Yeah, well, that they do, Hoyt. That they do.
I think I'll wander down there and see if I can be of any help to those poor people.
Hoyt walked quickly toward the group gathered in front of what he recognized as the First Territorial Bank, his long legs carrying him quickly toward the crowd. He spotted the sheriff standing in front of the bank. Hoyt had made the sheriff's acquaintance when he came to Tucson a week earlier. In his line of work, it usually helped to know the local lawman. The sheriff was talking to a man Hoyt had never seen before, a young gent who had the look of an Easterner about him. Hoyt walked up in time to hear the hombre declare that he was posting a 10 grand reward for the men who robbed the bank. And that reward was just the way Abner Hoyt liked it. Dead or alive.
Hold on, boys.
I don't see anyone coming, boss. You think we lost them?
I don't even think they've started yet. It'll take them a while to get organized. We got a good head start on them. They'll follow for a time, then they'll stop once they see where we're headed.
Where are we going?
Ambush Valley.
I ain't never heard of that. Where is it?
About 2 miles east of hell, boy.
It's someplace they won't follow us, because nobody knows how to get in or out without dying of thirst or getting bushwhacked. Nobody except Cortez here, that is.
You know the way?
Like the back of my hand, boy.
Cortez was half Mex, half Apache. He had grown up in the rough country where they were headed now, and knew every rock, every ravine, and more importantly, every waterhole. When McCoy had decided to hit the first territorial bank in Tucson, he had conceived an audacious getaway plan. The gang would head straight for Ambush Valley.
Why did they call it Ambush Valley?
While Geronimo and his Apaches were still raising hell and terrifying every white settler in the territory, a company of U.S. cavalry had ridden into the valley looking for them. They didn't realize that was exactly what Geronimo wanted them to do. The soldiers had just arrived in Arizona. They had no idea what sort of nightmare they were getting into.
They found out soon enough. The valley is a twisting maze of rocks and cactus and no water.
The soldier boys didn't know how to get back out, so they wandered around for most of a day in the baking heat until they were weak from thirst and baking in the sun.
Them Apaches knew every inch of that valley. They've been following the cavalrymen all day. They fell on them and wiped them out almost to the last man.
They saved a couple of troopers who weren't badly wounded, so they'd have somebody to torture to death. A little light entertainment around the campfire that night.
So they call it Ambush Valley. But for us, thanks to Cortez, it's a way out of here.
Those soldiers probably would have all died of thirst before they ever found their way out of the trap. But there was water in Ambush Valley. You just had to know where to find it. Cortez knew, or at least claimed he did. And McCoy tended to believe it, because Cortez's life would be on the line too, just like the rest of the gang's. It was a foolproof plan, as long as the outlaws didn't allow the posse to catch up to them before they reached Ambush Valley.
Now, dadgummit, you don't need to go posting a reward, Mr. Browning. It's my duty as sheriff to go after those varmints, and I'm sure there'll be plenty of civic-minded folks willing to join a posse. After all, a lot of people in town had money in your bank. Just let me get this bullet scratch of my arm patched up and...
My men and I will ride now.
Who are you? He's a bounty hunter. Him and some of his friends rode into Tucson not long ago. I was afraid when you said that about a reward that he'd hear about it. Didn't figure he'd be right behind you. You got a nose for sniffing out money, don't you, Hoyt?
With a beak like yours, I wouldn't be talking about nobody else's nose. Abner Hoyt.
Conrad Browning.
Conrad returned Hoyt's grip with more strength than Hoyt expected.
This is my bank that was just robbed.
How much they get?
Enough to make the reward I'm offering worthwhile. And they murdered several people, including 2 of my employees and another man.
Anybody get a good look at them and know who they were?
They had masks on. I never saw their faces. And I don't think anybody else did either.
Could have been Cicero McCoy and his bunch. I've heard rumors that they're down here in these parts. They held up a train west of Flagstaff a couple of weeks ago, so they've had plenty of time to get here.
I've seen a lot of reward dodgers on Cicero McCoy. He's wanted in Utah, California, New Mexico, and here in Arizona.
Do you think you can catch this man McCoy, Mr. Hoyt?
I got 6 men who are as hard as nails. Several of them are good trackers. We'll run those outlaws to the ground, whoever they are. Don't worry about that, Mr. Browning.
Very well. You heard the reward offer. I'll stand behind it.
Now just wait just a damn minute. I haven't deputized you and your partners as members of the posse yet, Hoyt.
And I don't give a damn about that. There's nothing in the law that says we can't go after robbers on our own. We'll be riding as soon as I can round up my men and get our horses saddled.
Damn it!
Conrad didn't know what the sheriff was truly mad at, missing out on the reward, or not having truly deputized men go after the outlaws. But Conrad didn't care, and it didn't seem like Abner Hoyt did either. Rebel was fully dressed by the time Conrad got back up to the hotel room. That was a shame, he thought, but only briefly. As much as he loved her, his mind was focused now on the outrage that had taken place a short time earlier. The loss of the money, the murder of his employees, the wanton slaughter of another man, all of it combined to fill Conrad with a smoldering rage. When Conrad first met Rebel Callahan, she'd been dressed like a man, which was fitting considering that she could ride and shoot as well or better than most men. Since their marriage, she had started dressing like a lady, as befitted the wife of one of the most important businessmen in the country. Now she wore a pale blue gown that went well with her blue eyes, tanned skin, and thick blonde hair.
What happened?
The bank was robbed, just as I feared.
The bank we visited just this morning?
That's right. The outlaws killed Mr. Wick, the manager, and one of the tellers.
Oh my God!
It gets worse than that. They killed one of the tellers and a man on the street while they were making their getaway. They cleaned out the bank, too. I checked on that myself. $80,000 gone.
Oh, Conrad.
The worst of it, though, is the loss of life. I hate outlaws. I hate the way they think they can just cut down anyone who's unlucky enough to be in their way.
Oh, I'm sure the sheriff will go after them and bring them to justice.
I'm not so certain. The sheriff doesn't strike me as being all that competent. Luckily, there's a group of professional manhunters in town. Their leader has volunteered them to track down the killers.
Professional manhunters? You mean bounty hunters, Conrad? You offered a reward for the men who robbed the bank?
Well, what was I supposed to do? I want those bastards brought to justice, if you pardon my French.
Oh, you don't have to apologize. They sound like bastards to me, too. But bounty hunters aren't much better. They're killers, too. They've just got the law on their side.
That's an important distinction.
Well, I reckon so. Was the reward you offered dead or alive?
Of course.
Then if those bounty hunters catch up to the robbers, they'll bring them back dead.
And that won't bother me a bit.
Hoyt's men had been scattered all through Tucson in various saloons, whorehouses, and gambling dens, with the exception of Bartholomew Leaf, who was having his picture made in a photographer's studio when Hoyt found him. Leaf was an Englishman and just about the vainest son of a bitch Hoyt had ever met. He was also a hell of a shot with a rifle. They had all come quickly and ready to ride when they were told the size of the reward. When Hoyt reached the livery stable where they had left their horses, he found all of them, Leaf in his sober suit and black derby, the pug-nosed Coleman brothers, Ben and Jack, the deceptively friendly face of Joaquin Escobar, swarthy Deke Mantee, who looked more like a Mexican than Escobar did, and Bardwell, a man so average-looking that you'd forget about him 2 minutes after you'd been talking to him. Leaf already had the stable keeper and both hostlers hard at work saddling the group's horses.
Now you said the reward's $10,000?
That's right. That sound worth it to you? We'll stop at the store and pick up some ammunition and supplies before we ride out. The outlaws were headed southwest when they left town.
There's not much in that direction until you get to the border. And then, there's nothing over there either.
And that's why we're taking supplies and water with us. We may be out on the trail for several days and there won't be any place to stock up again.
You don't think they'll head to Ambush Valley, do you?
You scared of them Apaches, ain't you, Escobar?
Anyone with half a brain worries about the Apache when they're in Arizona. Those raiding parties still make it over to this side of the border plenty.
I'm not afraid of the Apaches. I just hope we don't have to follow them into Ambush Valley.
Yes, my word, I hope not. That's the most uncivilized place I've ever seen.
If that's where they're headed, we need to stop them before they get there. I don't want to have to track them through that hellhole. But just in case we do, Joaquin, you know where to find water in there?
I know where some of the holes are supposed to be, Senor Hoyt. That does not mean they will be there, or that they will have water in them.
Let's just catch up to the bastards before they get there.
Yeah, we're wasting time. Come on!
They were a hard, dangerous-looking group of riders as they left the stable. As they trotted up to the general store, Hoyt frowned. Another bunch of horsemen were gathering there, townies from the looks of them. Hoyt spotted the sheriff among them. He had a bandage wrapped around his left forearm. It didn't look like a professional job, though. It looked like the sheriff had just tied a rag around his wounded arm.
Well, you put together your posse in a hurry, Sheriff.
You didn't give me any choice. I couldn't let you ride out after those bank robbers by yourself. Now, these men have already been deputized. So if you and your men will raise your right hands, Hoyt, I'll swear you in.
Let's just skip that part of it.
We need to do this the proper way, Hoyt.
Jack, Ben, go in there and gather up the things we'll need. Make it fast.
The Colemans dismounted and hurried into the store to follow Hoyt's orders. The sheriff stood there, fuming and glaring for a few seconds.
You refuse to let me officially deputize you?
That's right. No offense, Sheriff, but I'll be damned if I'm gonna swear to follow orders from you.
I'm the law around here!
And my men and I know what we're doing. Probably better than you do.
Well, I may not be able to stop you from going, but by God, you better not get in our way! Come on, men! Let's mount up!
Hey, Joaquin. You and Bob go pick up the trail before these amateurs ruin it. We'll catch up to you later.
Okay, boss.
The two bounty hunters nodded, wheeled their horses, and galloped around the posse.
I'm warning you, Hoyt! You stay out of our way!
The sheriff and his men had started moving, but they were slow about it. A posse made up of storekeepers, freighters, layabouts, and saddle tramps could never be as swift and professional as Hoyt and his men. Escobar and Bardwell had raced out of sight while the members of the posse were all still trying to get headed in the same direction.
I hope that by some quirk of circumstances, those fellows don't catch up to the outlaws before we do.
They'll probably be wiped out if that happens.
Not our problem.
Cicero McCoy kept his men moving at a fast pace the rest of that day following the bank robbery in Tucson. It would take most of the next day to reach Ambush Valley, a day to make it through the hellish place, and then part of the day after that to reach the border. They would have to stop when darkness fell. When you rode at night, it was too easy to get lost and start going in circles in this trackless wilderness. And there would only be a sliver of moon for the next couple of nights. McCoy had taken that into account when he was planning the bank job too. Any posse that followed them from Tucson would have to call a halt for darkness or risk losing the trail completely. Things could still go wrong, but McCoy liked their chances. He had planned well, and so far, it was working. Cortez was in the lead now, since he knew this country better than any of the rest of them. He decided when to stop, and held up a hand to signal a halt when the sun was down and stars had begun to twinkle into existence in the sable sky above them.
Is it a good place, boss?
Gold camp. Tend to your horses before you look to your own needs.
That was just common sense, like not building a fire. Without the horses, they'd stand no chance at all.
Two men on guard at all times. Beck, Newton, you'll take the first watch.
Got it, Mr. McCoy.
These eight men had ridden together for long enough so that they functioned like a well-oiled machine. Within half an hour, the horses had been grained and watered, and all of them were asleep except McCoy and the two guards. McCoy should have been asleep too, but he was too keyed up to doze off just yet. He sat with his back propped against a rock and took off his hat. He ran his fingers through his hair, which was completely white, despite the fact that he was only 32 years old. His hair had turned white before he was 25. Some hombres were like that. He wasn't vain enough to let it bother him. A cold breeze blew. Nights cooled off in a hurry in this semi-desert country. The rock at McCoy's back retained a lot of the day's warmth, though, and kept him from getting too chilly. Without being aware of it, he drifted off to sleep. The men who had the turn before them woke McCoy and Cortez to take the last watch.
Always surprises me how quiet it can get at night.
Quiet is good. We can hear what's coming.
Well, we'll hear the posse if they get anywhere near us.
They won't sneak up on us. White men don't move that quietly.
The Apache are another story, though.
See.
McCoy had stiffened as he heard the owl hoot in the distance. Didn't have to mean anything, he told himself. Chances were it was a real owl, not some painted savage. He waited tensely, but didn't hear any more hoots. Finally, he relaxed again, while still remaining vigilant.
Time to go.
McCoy nodded his agreement. By the time night came again, McCoy thought, they would be in Ambush Valley. And they would be safe. The posse had been half a mile out of Tucson when Abner Hoyt and his remaining companions passed them. Hoyt and his men were all mounted on fine horses, the best they could afford, because a man's life often depended on his horse, especially when he was engaged in such a dangerous profession as bounty hunting. The posse members, on the other hand, rode a mixture of cow ponies, draft animals, buggy horses, and nags whose best days were long since past. As they passed the posse, the sheriff had glared hard at Hoyt and his men. Hoyt couldn't help but grin. They left the posse in their dust. Now they could follow the trail of the bank robbers themselves. Bardwell and Escobar were somewhere up ahead, making sure they didn't lose the trail. But for now, Hoyt and his partners had no trouble following. Hoyt spotted a lone rider coming toward them. He waved his men to a halt. They waited with their hands near their guns, just in case that horseman wasn't friendly. A few minutes later, they relaxed as they recognized him as Bob Bardwell.
Joaquin's about a mile ahead. Says that we've cut into the lead some, but they're moving fast too, and we won't be able to catch them till sometime tomorrow.
What if we rode through the night?
Well, then we risk losing the trail altogether. Joaquin's waiting for us, and when we catch up to him, we need to stop and make camp.
All right. As long as we stop them before they get to Ambush Valley, that's all that matters.
How do you know that's where they're going, Abner?
Where else could they be headed? If all they wanted to do was head across the border, they could have ridden straight south to Nogales. Problem is, men on fast horses might have caught them before they got there. It's a longer run to Ambush Valley, but they'd have to figure that if they make it through there, nobody will come after them.
Stupid bastards will die of thirst in there.
They'll be buzzard bait before they ever even get out of that valley.
I don't believe we should count on that, my good friends. No. If that's where they're headed, they most probably have someone with them who knows the way through that despicable place.
Let's go. We still need to catch up to Joaquin.